From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The body of President George H.W. Bush arrives in Washington, D.C. today. It will lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda until Wednesday. Memorial services for the 41st president have also brought together members of both parties for a few days at least. President Trump and lawmakers have reportedly agreed to avoid a government shutdown this week. Joining us now is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Jeremy.
So President Bush's remains are en route to the Capitol from Houston. Just give us a sense of what to expect over the next few days at these memorial services.
Well, this is really what passes for a state funeral. He is going to land at his casket, will land at Andrews Air Force Base today. He will go to the Capitol. He'll lie in state there. There will be public viewing. And there will be a service tonight with remarks from congressional leaders. Then on Wednesday, there will be a funeral at the National Cathedral. Then his remains will go to Houston and then by train to College Station, Texas, where the Bush Library is.
And on Wednesday, that funeral at the National Cathedral, the Obamas will be there. George W. Bush and Laura Bush will be there. It's been a while since we've seen all these people together with President Trump. I was reading that just as recently as November that President Trump and President Obama haven't talked since the inauguration.
Yeah, and I think that they'll be honoring George H.W. Bush. I don't think that there will be any fisticuffs between the two of them. I don't think that's a problem. But the interesting thing is that Trump's presence there, the Bush family and the Trump and Donald Trump did not get along. They didn't like each other. Trump will not have a speaking role at the funeral. And he recently, in recent months, had kind of gratuitously and apropos of nothing taken off after George H.W. Bush and particularly attacked his 1,000 points of light. That was the George H.W. Bush volunteer program where people would come together to volunteer for activities that would improve their communities. Apparently, Trump didn't like that at all, and he made fun of it at rallies. And he was given an opportunity over the weekend by reporters who asked him if he regretted any of the things he had said about the Bush family, and he didn't answer the question.
Mm. A lot of people remembering President George H.W. Bush, including President Obama. Here he is speaking to 60 Minutes on CBS over the weekend.
He was a good reminder that as fiercely as we may fight on policy and on issues, that ultimately we're Americans first. And that kind of attitude is something that I think a lot of people miss.
There have also been critics of President Bush, even from within his own party. He worked with Democrats on that tax increase in 1990, went to war in Kuwait. He was a fierce campaigner. Yesterday, Democratic strategist Donna Brazile said this on ABC News.
He had faults, and one of them was on the 64 Civil Rights Act he opposed. And one of the reasons why I opposed George Bush fiercely was because he was not a champion at that time. But in other ways, he did support civil rights by the appointment of people like Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice and so many others.
Mara, how are people remembering President Bush, both the good and the bad?
I think that they're remembering him in all of his complexity. I think one of the most important things about him, and President Obama just spoke to that in the cut you just played, was that the people he campaigned against, he saw them as his opponents, not his enemies. Hmm. And he did. He often was on the wrong side of civil rights issues. For instance, he was famous for using the Willie Horton ad against Michael Dukakis, a race-based campaign when he ran for president. But as Donna Brazile just pointed out, he also was able to do other things, appoint people like Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. So I think he'll be seen as a transitional figure because the Republican Party that he represented and led, of course, no longer exists.
Well, that's the other thing I want to ask you about. You were covering the campaign back in 1992. You were a congressional correspondent during the Bush presidency. How different are things in Washington today from the way they were back then?
Well, they're very different in terms just of the tenor of political debate, which is now kind of all-out war and apocalyptic. And, you know, if your opponent wins, it's the end of the world. Therefore, any means are justified. And President George H.W. Bush represented a more civil era that seems to be gone. But I do think the biggest difference is the Republican Party and the kind of moderate Republicanism that George H.W. Bush represented. He was for the Clean Air Act. He had a vision of free trade. He had a vision of America's role in the world as the leader of the free world. He stood for decency and certain character traits being important. Those things seem to be at least in abeyance now in the Republican Party. Free trade, free markets, America as the leader of the free world, those are not things that Donald Trump believes in.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, who will help guide us through the next several days in Washington. Mara, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as American dignitaries gather in Washington to remember President Bush, world leaders from nearly 200 countries convene in Poland for the annual UN Climate Summit. Here's historian Sir David Attenborough at the opening ceremony.
We're facing a man-made disaster of global scale, our greatest threat in thousands of years. If we don't take action, the collapse of our civilizations is on the horizon.
And the summit comes after a series of equally dire warnings. The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reported in October that rising global temperatures could be catastrophic and irreversible as early as 2040 without major intervention. The White House released the fourth national U.S. climate assessment 2 weeks ago with grim findings. Matt McGraw is environmental correspondent for the BBC. He joins us from the summit in Katowice, Poland. And Matt, this is the biggest international climate summit since the signing of the 2015 Paris Agreement that planned to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But President Trump says he'll withdraw the U.S. from that agreement in 2020. There are U.S. federal officials and a coalition of state and local government leaders there, but how effective can efforts be without the U.S. really on board?
Yeah, I think in fairness to the process, they've, over the last couple of years, gotten quite used to the absence of the United States. The United States delegation is here. They, as you say, they won't be able to leave fully until 2020. And they've been kind of just marking time, really, not really taking part in many of the discussions in big ways. That doesn't mean that people are falling apart or falling down. Some countries have taken the opportunity of President Trump's cover, really, to maybe fall back a little bit on their commitments, countries such as Russia and Turkey and Australia. But others, I think, have stepped up. And I think in some respects, it's kind of had the counter effect of galvanizing a lot of countries such as France, Germany and others and the European Union to go even further.
Well, let's talk about that. The meeting is meant to finalize the rules and details of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, including how countries will track and report their efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. What are the sticking points here?
Yeah, it's interesting that, of course, one of the things that the United States wanted from this particular agreement, from the Paris deal, was a solid measuring, reporting, verifying system so that when a country says it did something, there were checks and balances to see that it did those things. And it's interesting that that's a key element of the rule book that they're trying to work out as we go forward. There are many dimensions to this. At the moment, the rule book runs to 300 pages. There's lots of brackets around lots of the text, which means it's in dispute. It covers a whole range of things from measuring, reporting, verifying, finance, a whole thing about timelines when countries report their emissions. So it's all very technical, really boring, to be honest with you. But the interesting thing about it is that without it, without that rule book, the next step in terms of making the Paris deal operational, remember, it doesn't come into force until 2020. Well, then, if that rule book isn't there, if people are just putting on paper anything they like, then it really could take the power from that particular pact.
Well, some at-risk countries already seeing major impacts of climate change are going to have the chance to plead for immediate action at this summit. This is Fiji, Nigeria, Bangladesh. Any chance of that?
I think so. I think that I think there's a lot of goodwill in the conference towards developing countries and island states and the plight that they're suffering. I mean, it doesn't really have the power here to dole out immediate lumps of cash, but it certainly can serve as a, I suppose, a global stage for countries to make their plights known on issues of climate.
Look, what is the talk there, Matt, of a world leader, President Trump, so dismissing what the preponderance of science says is, you know, man's impact on climate change, or even the impact of climate change regardless of how it was created, for instance, the economic impact, just a complete dismissal.
Yeah, I think in many ways people are kind of over President Trump. I think he was elected just, his election was, happened just, this meeting was happening 2 years ago. And I think people recognize that the United States is pulling out. But as you say, there have been lots of different people coming here. The governor of California, Jerry Brown, various senators, representatives of cities and states all over the United States saying we are still in and that coalition is still quite strong, making that sound for America. And I think the clarity of the scientific reports we've seen over the last couple of months from the IPCC, from the World Meteorological Organization, from the UN itself, all reinforce the view that, look, something serious is happening to the planet. We have very little time to do something about it. And it just kind of makes President Trump's dismissal of the science just seem, you know, it's hard to find the right words, actually. It just seems inadequate and prehistoric in some ways.
Matt McGraw, environmental correspondent for the BBC there at the annual UN Climate Summit in Katowice, Poland. Matt, thank you.
Well, thank you.
How lucky are we? Mark Knopfler is out with a new album, his first in 3 years. The former frontman for Britain's Dire Straits, one of the world's best-selling acts from the late 1970s to the early 1990s. Everybody, sing along. In 1995, Mark Knopfler went solo. He's been busy, 9 solo albums. His latest is Down the Road Wherever. Here's a little of the lead single.
Flash goes a little hummingbird, a dart and whirring thread. At the screen door by his lemon tree, out here with the quick and the dead. Designer blinds above L.A., frame the perfect view. It's gonna be another day of sun and shameless blue.
That's Good On You, Son, from Mark Knopfler's new album, Down the Road Wherever. And Mark Knopfler joins us from the BBC studios. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here, Robin.
What a pleasure. And what does making an album now mean for you? Is it the music? Is it the songs burbling inside you?
Yes, the songs keep on coming. In fact, the older I get, the more that they do. I have far too many songs for this record, and I'm still just trying to do the same thing, which is to write a good song if I can, then you try to make a good record of it. And that's it, really. It amounts to just about everything that I want to do, all that I want to do in life.
You said in the Telegraph that you've got a junkyard in the back of your head, and instead of motorcycle parts, it's couplets and verse fragments?
Yes, but it's something that's come since I was a baby. I could sing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer at 18 months, and I could remember words from songs that I didn't really understand, like Big Rock Candy Mountain, that was played as a children's favorites on Listen With Mother stuff from over 60 years ago.
Oh my. Let's listen to another song from the album, and there's a reference that leads to something we wanted to ask you about. This is One Song at a Time.
My whistle under the archway still echoes down the street, all the way back to Deptford, days and nights down by the creek. Notes as big as riverboats still echoing through the clubs, where the horns of the trains down the old back lanes and the lights of the corner pubs.
You refer here to Deptford days. You're an English teacher. When you formed Dire Straits,
actually, the teaching job was only a job that to save my life from trying to be a musician. It did save my life, actually. It enabled me to get a motorcycle and then to swap that for an old car of my dad's, and then to be able to move gear around a little bit in terms of guitars and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. When we were talking before we came on air, I said, and you were a journalist, and you said, well, no, maybe cub reporter's better, Yorkshire Evening Post. But it all seems to be about the words.
I don't think I would have ended up as a songwriter quite the same without journalism. I think it made me sharpen my act up, get myself organized, learn how to condense things.
You also have to listen and observe. And I just want to hear a little bit of a Dire Straits song. This is from 1985, because I love the story about what you were listening to that led to this song. Let's listen to a little of Money for Nothing. So you overheard a delivery guy putting down, but also envying rock stars, some guy in a store?
Yeah, well, I was living in New York part of the time, and I was in an electrical appliance store. There was a wall of televisions that were tuned to MTV. And there was a big meathead guy. And he was expounding his views about all these people in very colourful language, I have to say. But a lot of it was so classic that I just went straight to the sales desk or wherever it was, and I got a piece of paper and a pen, and I sat down in the kitchen display area in the window, and I started to write the song there.
Look at them yo-yos, that's the way you do it. You play the guitar on the MTV. That ain't working, that's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks for free. Now that ain't working, that's the way you do it.
Yeah, he was saying that's pretty smart. If you can do that, no idea, man. I think back then I was probably doing about, with Dire Straits, we were probably doing about 250 shows a year or whatever it would be, you know. And
you're the guy he was talking about.
Well, maybe, yeah, maybe. But I think a lot of kids get into rock and roll, they don't get into it to work, and it comes as a bit of a shock sometimes.
And it was. It was hard. You say at the time you felt like someone got the hold of the thread of your sweater and pulled it, and then you just unraveled.
Well, at the very beginning it seemed a little bit like that, because it was a real explosion, and we were, you know, number one all over the world. And for a songwriter, you know, you're just watching the world and occasionally writing a song. Whereas suddenly the world's watching you, or you think the world is.
Well, especially in your case, since you are given the mantle of guitar god, and the guitar playing is evident all over this new release. But I want to listen to, for some reason, in the middle of one of the pieces, you go into a solo of You'll Never Walk Alone.
yeah.
Beautiful.
You'll Never Walk Alone is a beautiful song, of course, and it's the theme, really, of the Liverpool Football Club. And, of course, I, as a supporter of Newcastle United, it's not one that gets sung in Newcastle, but I got the idea when my dad was in the hospital, which is very, very near where Newcastle play football, and he was in the hospital in the middle of the night feeling a little bit sorry for himself, and he heard a boy on the street singing that song. You know, it doesn't take a genius to work out that lad had come from Liverpool and he'd been to the match with Newcastle, and somehow he got lost. And singing his song to cheer himself up, and my dad found it, it brought his spirits back.
Yeah. That's Just a Boy Away from Home from Mark Knopfler. And now I picture a little movie with that boy and an old man listening. Always a story. Let's listen to a little more from the new release. I want to hear Heavy Up. People here love these lyrics and wondered if this was a conversation you might have had. Let's listen.
Your slack, your dimness is our loss. Condemns us to your point of view. Who could give a flying toss? What you like to chill out to? Why should I lighten up for you if you can heavy up for me?
Is that a conversation you've had?
No, it's just something that I heard somebody say once.
Yeah.
I'll lighten up for you if you'll heavy up for me. I thought it was great. But also, yeah, I mean, nowadays more than ever, I think it's probably got worse over the past 20 years. It's that, I don't know whether you found that, but everybody's got an opinion now, you know.
And, no, we never find that.
unfortunately, that also means that every fool's got an opinion.
Yeah. Well, can we listen to a little of When You Leave?
Sure.
Like it or not, how could I not have fallen? And now that I'm caught, how could I not
I don't know whether it's just getting older, but I suppose that song's been kicking around for a while. I never know when it's actually going to make enough sense to be a finished item. Mm. Some things can sit there for a long time, so there's no formula. If there was a formula, I promise I'd tell you what it is. Maybe it's also spending a lot of years listening to artists like Chet Baker and being influenced by the trumpet sound and just wanting to write something in that kind of vein.
We're going to play another song, Back on the Dance Floor, but I want to ask, it seems to be about, you know, going for the major score, you know, the... And you've got Grammys, Hall of Fame, the Order of the British Empire. Am I supposed to call you something like Lord or something?
No, I think a simple okay. Sir would be nice.
But what's left?
A little curtsy, perhaps. It's funny to me. It's just funny that, you know, that the thing goes on consuming you, you know, this. And actually, one of the last tours, my back gave up on me in Chicago, and I got a herniated disc.
Oh, boy.
I just kept going, you know. So I don't know what that is. I guess it means that I should maybe back off from playing live so much. That'll be the first casualty. But I hope to be able to go on writing and recording for a good while yet.
Yeah. Guitarist, songwriter, Mark Knopfler, his latest album, Down the Road Wherever. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin. I've really enjoyed talking to you. We're going for the major comeback, for the mother load, the mighty score. We'll be the toast of every knocked out boogie shack. And now we're back on the dance floor.
And back on the road, the American Lake of Mark's 2019 tour starts next August. And if you buy a ticket through his website, you get a free album. Join him in thwarting scalpers.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 400 points after the opening bell today. A temporary truce between the U.S. and China encouraged investors worried about an ongoing trade war. President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed over the weekend to temporarily hold off on new tariffs as the two countries work out the terms of a larger trade deal. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So President Trump called this an incredible deal that goes down as one of the largest deals ever made. Is this really a deal, or what is it? What does the U.S. get out of this?
I don't think this is a deal. Let's call it a 90-day timeout. And so during the next 90 days, all current tariffs on both sides between China and the U.S. remain in place. But I think the most important aspect of this is what will not happen, and that is that the United States will not be raising tariffs from 10 to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports that was slated to occur on January 1st. Now, additionally, China did say it's going to purchase more U.S. farm, energy, and industrial goods. That's hopefully to reduce the trade gap. And then early this morning, there was a tweet from President Trump saying that China has agreed to cut its 40% tariffs on American-made cars, although Chinese officials did not confirm or deny that assertion, so I'm not sure what to make of it.
And what do you make of the reaction on Wall Street that even though, you know, this is not a deal that goes on for any longer than 90 days, that the markets are so happy, like this is a big thing for them?
Yeah, it feels a little bit like a relief rally, just like it felt like a relief last week when we had comments from Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve chair, that indicated that maybe there aren't going to be 4 rate increases next week. All of this is conjecture. It really does tell you that a lot of investors have been anxious, not just about trade, but about rising interest rates as well as a slowing economy. So, you know, one day at a time, I wouldn't take too much out of this and start to think this is what's going to happen next year.
We also got news today that Qatar is pulling out of OPEC after 60 years in that powerful group of oil exporting countries. What do we need to know about that?
Well, you know, I guess that number one is that this is a big announcement. But, you know, remember that Qatar's oil output is just 2% of OPEC's total. It's about 600,000 barrels a day. Just think of that as a tiny fraction. Saudi Arabia does 10 or 11 million barrels. So the energy minister from Qatar says, hey, this is strictly a business decision. They want to focus more on their natural gas industry. And, you know, interestingly, he specifically dismissed the idea that this withdrawal is connected to politics. You might recall that Saudi Arabia had cut diplomatic ties and imposed a travel and trade boycott on Qatar in June of 2017, accusing of it financing terrorism. So, you know, I don't think this is the hugest deal for the oil market. Probably the oil market's more excited about the idea that perhaps we're going to see the economy loosen up a little bit in terms of the trade deal.
And right now, the oil market is also having an impact on the gas prices around this country, which are relatively low.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the oil market went from talking about $100 oil about 5 weeks ago. Then we were talking about $40 oil. And now you know what it's like to be a commodities trader, which is my first job on Wall Street.
Oh, wow.
So I will tell you that, you know, look, a lot of this stuff is fluid. Right. Remember, the oil market, it's controlled by Saudi Arabia and Russia. Those are the two main players. We are all bit players when taken against them.
Good to know that the oil market is fluid. Jill Schlesinger at CBS, thank you.
Take care.
With today's signing of the landmark Americans for Disabilities Act, every man, woman, and child with a disability can now pass through once closed doors into a bright new era of equality, independence, and freedom.
Former President George H.W. Bush at the signing of one of the most significant pieces of legislation he passed during his presidency, the Americans with Disabilities Act. That law prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities in employment, transportation, and public accommodations. And it was a model for similar civil rights laws around the world. Marian Vessels was there at the signing of the ADA in July 1990, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, let me start, first of all, just by asking you how the Americans with Disabilities Act changed your life.
It was an amazing transformation for me. I've used a wheelchair since I was in college when I broke my back, and I always had to call ahead to see if restaurants and other venues were accessible. I automatically presumed things were not going to be accessible, mm-hmm. and was delighted when they were. Today, I rarely call ahead and sometimes am disappointed when I realize that they're not accessible, or I have to think twice and make sure that I call ahead. The presumption is that things are going to be accessible.
They almost always are.
For the most part, but there's still a lot of old venues that are not, you know, not accessible and aren't required to be. But it, you know, it has been a tremendous sea change for people with disabilities.
How much did George H.W. Bush have to do with that?
A tremendous amount. In fact, I recently have been reviewing the history of the ADA for a lecture I was giving. And his work as vice president in helping to understand the issues and concerns of people with disabilities went a long way for his recognition that the ADA was critical and making sure that his administration did what was needed to get it passed.
So what are some of the challenges that remain? What still needs to be done for people with disabilities in this country?
Oh, there's tremendous amount of things that still need to be done. People with disabilities are still discriminated on the basis of their disability and employment. There are still many venues that are not accessible. People with disabilities still have a long way to go to be fully accepted as members of society. So the ADA is a great beginning, But even after all these years, we still have a long way to go.
And what do you think? I mean, today is not only a day that we're remembering George H.W. Bush, it's also the International Day of People with Disabilities. What do you think people that are listening to this need to know about what it's like at this point in 2018 to live with a disability?
Well, we have a lot more opportunities than we did in 1990. More and more people are being integrated into society. You'll see people with disabilities on the street. You'll see them in movies and on TV shows and on commercials. We now see that people with disabilities are to be expected to be included in society. And that's very exciting. And so the ADA has gone a long way for that full inclusion.
You were there at the signing in 1990 of the ADA. What do you remember about that day?
Oh, my gosh. It was such an exciting day. There were about 3,000 of us, folks with disabilities and those who advocated for the ADA, sitting on the White House lawn. And in typical D.C. weather for late July, it was horribly hot and humid. But there was this sense of excitement. I kind of refer to it as kind of like the 4th of July for people with disabilities because it was the beginning of our civil rights. There was just an electricity in the air, and it was just a beautiful day, and people from all over the country were there.
So former President George H.W. Bush is going to be lying in state at the Capitol. You're in Maryland. Do you intend to go and see him?
You know, it's something I hadn't thought about, but I've been watching all the ceremonies, and I was realizing that that's something that I, as a citizen, can do, and it's something I'm really considering now. Just this morning, thinking about, wow, I'm close enough that I could actually go and see a president in state, which is something that not many people can do.
That is Marion Vessels, who is a disability rights advocate. She was the director of the Mid-Atlantic ADA Center in Maryland for 20 years, and she was there on that day in 1990 when President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Well, producers of a spirit distilled from agave in northern Mexico are trying to sell more of their product on the international market, but some worry that popularizing the drink could mean sacrificing the traditions that set it apart from other liquors. Kendall Blust of KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Hermosillo, Mexico, reports.
Julian Urquijo and Manuel Chacon heave giant clubs in tandem, crushing roasted agave hearts in a wooden trough they call a canoe. Their ancestors crushed agave like this for 500 years. It will be fermented and distilled into a regional liquor known as Bacanora. But even here, in the town of Bacanora, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who makes it that way anymore. Chacon is a Bacanora producer and a native of this small Sonoran town tucked into the vast green foothills of the Sierra Madre mountain range of Mexico.
Esa actividad era...
He says mashing the agave used to be one of the hardest parts of the Bacanora making process, the part no one wanted to do. So, over time, axes replaced the heavy wooden bats, and these days some producers use wood chippers. It's one of many changes to the labor-intensive process of making Bacanora, changes some worry could alter the essence of the lightly sweet and smoky liquor. Bacanora started as rough fermented agave heart. 400 years ago, Spaniards introduced distilleries that softened the drink and made it popular throughout Sonora. But in 1915, the governor of Sonora enacted prohibition laws that sent it underground for the next 77 years, until 1992.
So that was a big wall Bacanora faced.
That's Alberto Navarro. He's an expert on agave distillates. He says under Prohibition, Bacanora producers were persecuted and sometimes killed for making their moonshine. At the same time, its better-known cousin tequila was becoming internationally recognized.
I don't see a reason why Bacanora shouldn't be growing importantly if the right path is found.
He thinks Bacanora can become competitive in those same international markets, particularly because its origins are unique. It can only be made and sold from 35 Sonoran towns, and it has to be made with just one local type of agave, Angustifolia Hau.
The soul of Sonora is in the spirit. And I think you can taste that.
North of the border, Doug Smith is passionate about Bacanora. He owns Exo Coffee Roast Company in Tucson. Coffee by day, but mezcal by night.
It's sort of the desert in its different dimensions. Taste like it comes from arid lands.
He says right now there's only one brand of Bacanora available in Arizona, and he'd love to offer a wider variety of the Sonoran spirit in his mezcal bar, but not at the cost of losing its artisanal quality.
I think it's worth doing. It's really worth doing, but it needs to be done carefully. A more artisanal route as opposed to a more industrial route. That's going to be the conflict about the future of Bacanora, I think.
Back in Bacanora, a local makes the liquor in a corner of his yard just up the hill from his family's chicken coop.
Lo hacen como una tradición.
Producer Chacon says most Bacanora is made informally and sold locally as a side job, but he is trying to turn it into a formal business. He's modernized his distillery, or vinata. A machine crushes the roasted agave, and a shiny copper still has replaced the typical pot still plastered with mud. Still, he insists that his production will always be artisanal.
Sí puede ser que algún productor...
Chacon says producers who go the industrial route do so at their own risk. But most want their Bacanora to be 100% agave and artisanal. That's what gives the liquor its special taste and what will make it valuable on the international market, he says. And Chacon wants it to be profitable. He sees Bacanora as a path to development for his and other rural communities in this region. For Here and Now, I'm Kendall Blust.
Imagine you're in a terrible nightmare. You're suddenly surrounded by giants who swoop in and seem to lick you on the face. What is that, a kiss? And pinch your cheeks, and maybe they don't smell so good, or they hold you too tight. Well, you've just envisioned the way the holidays feel for a lot of little kids. And if you're the parent of young children, you may be the one telling them to give those giants, Uncle Harry or Aunt Susie or the guy down the street, hugs and kisses back, which is well-meaning, but it is also, apparently, a new no-no, because many kids don't want to, and more pediatricians and psychologists are telling parents don't force them. One of them is New York pediatrician Jack Levine, an executive committee member on developmental and behavioral pediatrics at the American Academy of Pediatrics. And Dr. Levine, it might seem obvious, you know, forced affection is a little creepy, but remind us, why not do it?
Well, if you force children to hug or kiss someone who they may not know very well, then they're not having a say in the decision on who to show their affection to. And then they begin to feel that showing this affection is expected at someone else's asking, and that their feelings and thoughts don't really matter on the issue, which is not a very positive experience for them.
Right. You don't teach them about autonomy over their own body.
That's correct. Yeah. Yes. And they feel that external forces are more or equally as important as their own feelings and who they should be kissing and hugging, and then later on in life who they should be intimate with.
Right. But, you know, this can make parents feel embarrassed, right? Because it feels as if their child is not respecting an elder or not functioning in some way. So how should parents handle this?
People have to understand that children have individual differences, as do adults, and that some children have a temperament where it's a little slower for them to warm up to people. Other children may have social-emotional skills in which they take a longer time before they like to talk to people, or their ability to make friends is a little bit slower than other children. And even language skills on occasion can be different, and some children don't feel as comfortable in conversation. And all of this is okay, and that children just need to progress at their own speed, and they need the support and love of their caregivers to nurture them along the way and shepherd them so that when they're ready to do these things, they can do them and feel good about it.
Right. But we understand at a certain point, you know, kids we know are very self-centered. The world revolves around them, and a part of childhood is learning to have empathy for other people, and one of the ways to do that is to make eye contact. So some are encouraging parents to just say, okay, you don't have to hug, you don't have to touch, but just look somebody in the eye.
Some children don't like to look at people in the eye. Some kids are a little more socially anxious than others, but there's a lot of other ways that children can show respect for their relatives. They can take their coats when they come in. They can make drawings for them. They can make place cards, do a number of other things rather than things that they feel uncomfortable with. Yeah. So I think it's important for parents to discuss with their child, prepare them, even role play with them perhaps, and then give the child a say and some forewarning and give them an opportunity to express their own feelings on how they want to show their respect to their relatives.
Well, you know, to your point that some kids don't like to make eye contact, they're just not ready yet, we should say that children on the autism spectrum may be very uncomfortable with that. We're reading that there are some families that put together picture books. You know, here's who these people are who are coming. Because you forget, for a little kid who's at about knee height, this can be overwhelming to suddenly have a room filled with people who want to hug you.
Very much so. And forcing them to do things makes matters worse. Most kids will come around, I believe, you know, and they will develop the social skills that are appropriate for them and for their family and getting along with relatives. And it's very important for parents to support their child in their decisions and feelings that they have about themselves and their bodies and how they relate to other people are validated.
In this last year, the Girl Scouts put out a memo titled, Reminder, She Doesn't Owe Anyone a Hug, Not Even at the Holidays. And they have a developmental psychologist, Andrea Bastiani-Archibald, who says the notion of consent may seem grown up, and like something that doesn't pertain to children, but the lessons girls learn when they're young about setting physical boundaries and expecting them to be respected last a lifetime. And others are pointing out that always shaming a child for not doing something a parent wants, like, you know, hug your Uncle Fred, is just a no-no. But also characterizing the behavior, like saying she's just shy or she's just this or that. They're saying don't do that either, because then you have labeled them.
Yes, and usually the label is perceived in a negative way. And this goes back to the whole idea of individual differences, that some children maybe not as outgoing. And one of the challenges with caregivers and parents is that their child's social ability and their temperament may be somewhat different than their own. So you may be a very outgoing person and always so happy to see your relatives and hug and kiss them. And your child may be a little more inhibited and a little bit more cautious, and you may interpret that as a negative thing rather than just as the child, you know, being themselves. So We need to understand very much that it's not about labeling, and it's about accepting the kids for where they are and encouraging them to be able to make good decisions.
They're just doing what a lot of us wish we could do a lot of the time, and, you know, protecting their own space. That's pediatrician Jack Levine, a member of the executive committee of Developmental and Behavioral Pediatrics at the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Levine, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.